Well, it is good to be with you today, not because I'm speaking, but because it's always a blessing and a privilege to be together with brothers and sisters of like precious faith. My story begins in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. I was born in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, which is a small city about 35 miles east of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. My parents were Elmer and Anna Mary Lehman Ressler, and I was the first of eight children, six of us boys and two sisters. My father was born in the Ephrata area and was a member of the Church of the Brethren at the time that he met my mother, who was from the Church of the Horning Church, or Black Bumper, as we sometimes refer to it back east. My great-grandfather was from the New Holland area, and he had a reputation for being the town drunk. My great-grandmother worked in a New Holland hotel as a barmaid and reportedly did some other things, whatever it took to keep food on the table. And I'm not sure about the relationship that my grandfather might have had with my great-grandfather, but my father's relationship and my grandfather's relationship was not good. My father left home at the age of 17 to make his own way in the world. I don't really know a whole lot about my maternal great-grandmother, great-grandfather, but I do know that they moved from Pennsylvania to the northwest corner of Iowa, Osceola County, May City, to be part of a Mennonite settlement there, a settlement that lasted about 30 years before disintegrating. And my grandfather was born in Iowa and then moved back to Pennsylvania, where he met and married my grandmother, who was from the Pike Church. In fact, both of them were members of the Pike Church at that time, and then later became members of the Horning Church, where my grandfather served as bishop. My mother's family, my father's family was large. My mother's was a little bit larger, and at the early age of 8 or 9, I think she was put out into a home just to work for her keep, to help reduce some of the load at home. So in terms of early childhood, I lived in the Myerstown area, which is just east of Lebanon, and my parents decided to settle on a Mennonite church, one having come from the Horning Church, one from the Brethren. We settled, I guess, somewhere in the middle, I don't know. But attended Crawls Mennonite Church. And my memories of Myerstown are beginning to fade, but I do remember church as an important part of our life. In the spring of 1952, life changed pretty dramatically. We moved from Myerstown, which was a fairly safe, I believe, Mennonite community, and we moved to southeastern Pennsylvania to a little town called Avondale, down about 4 miles from the Delaware state line, down into that area of the world that is sometimes referred to as the mushroom capital of the world. But there were no Martins, Stauffers, Zimmermans, Zooks, Stolzfusses, Mullets, Beaches, or anybody else there. We had names like Talamonte and Frezzo and Lito and Panini and Pisano and a few Wilsons and Thomases. So it was a very un-Mennonite community. So away from family, away from friends, away from the church that we knew. But my grandfather had learned a trade as a bricklayer as a young man, and he and four other men from that area were driving to Wilmington, Delaware every day for work, which, depending on where they worked, was anywhere from 70 to 90 miles one way. He decided that it made more sense to move to the area, so he did move down to Avondale. About 2 years prior to our coming to Avondale, there was a mission work started in Kennett Square. It began on the lawn of a home that was reached through street meetings, and they had begun to have services in the afternoon in the building by the time we had moved there, and we started going to Kennett Square Mennonite Church. Took our membership there, of course. It just would have been my father and mother at that time. But I spent the next 50 years of my life in that congregation, some of it as a child growing up, and then after that serving in every capacity, including pastor, with the exception of sewing circle. I didn't have any involvement in that. But I pastored there for about 21 and a half years, and it was a relatively small congregation. One of the blessings of small congregations is that everybody has to work, so you learn how to do something. That's a good thing. And it felt sometimes like we were training people to populate some of the larger churches with positions of need. So, but it was a good experience. Living in Avondale, I began to learn something about separation and nonconformity. In fifth grade or sixth grade, and I forget which one now, we were practicing for a music program, and we're told on the night of the program we're going to need to put a long tie on for the program for the parents. And three of us from the attending school there from the Church of Kenneth Square said, "That's not going to happen. We don't wear long ties. We're not allowed to wear long ties." So we were immediately sent to the principal's office and threatened with expulsion. Well, apparently after some phone calls back and forth between school and parents and maybe the church pastor, I'm not sure, we finally were given permission to sing in the program without wearing long ties. But it was a time of beginning to learn that there is a difference between the church and the world. There were some other lessons to be learned, obviously, along the way. I recall we lived in a rundown farmer's tenement house that the wind kind of blew straight through, and up the driveway some distance was a old rundown shed where my father kept an animal. I think it was a young steer, perhaps. And I had been told I needed to feed this animal. And I don't know, I guess like I probably did many other times, I didn't get it done. So I went into supper and he asked me if I had fed the animal, and I said I hadn't. And my father was kind of a no-nonsense fella, no shirking responsibility with him. He was all about work and doing what you're supposed to do. So he told me that I would need to feed the animal before I could get to eat. And that created a dilemma because I liked to eat, but the problem was it was starting to get dark, and I didn't like the dark. So I went out, left the kitchen, went down the back steps, and thought the better idea would be just to sit under the back steps for about the appropriate amount of time, and I'd just go back home again. So I did. I went back in, and he asked me if I'd fed the animal, and I lied. I said I had. Well, two lessons learned that evening. One is that sitting underneath the steps for what seemed like an eternity apparently wasn't enough time to walk up the lane and feed the animal. The second one was that lying was not right. Lying was wrong. So I was ordered back out into the now dark night to go back up and feed. And that's probably the fastest that ever got done. But I was beginning to learn the important lesson that sin has its consequences. Also across the street from us, across the driveway, the old dirt lane, was another fairly rundown house. And a family from the South, what we referred to as the South, Tennessee or somewhere in that area, lived there. And the husband was a banjo picker. And he would invite his friends over to play bluegrass music with him. And so I got exposed early to bluegrass music. But my father had learned to play the guitar as a young person, and he would sometimes join in their picking sessions. And what seemed rather innocuous at the time would later bring unwanted fruit. Thinking of my years then, more or less as youth, in 1957 we moved about halfway between Avondale and Kenneth Square, which is moving east for us. My father had gone into business for himself, had bought a piece of property and had built a new house, and that was a luxury. We had central heat, and we now had indoor plumbing. The problem with the other house was that we had outdoor plumbing, and none of my brothers or sisters could ever bring themselves to go to the outhouse before it was dark, and then I would have to go with them. So it was really nice to have some indoor plumbing. Well, while living in that area then and attending Kenneth Square Summer Bible School in the eighth grade, I gave my heart to the Lord, made a decision for him, and began the journey of learning what it means to live for him. We had a small youth group at church. There might have been eight or nine of us boys who were all about the same age and all good friends. And we had some good Sunday school teachers. And they would take us occasionally on what we call VS weekend trips to New York City. to work at some of the mission stations there, cleaning, painting, repairing, whatever needed to be done. We've even go to Washington occasionally. But they also taught us well. One of the things that one of the brothers kept pounding into our heads time and time again was that from wrong, ruin, and sin, you're safe if you never begin. And so I've remembered that. I've tried to remember that at least over the years. Another one would always say you can't keep the birds from flying over your head, but you can keep them from building nests in your hair. And then just to make sure that we kept our conscience clean, we used to often sing, "There's a God who's standing at heaven's door. He's looking this universe o'er, and he sees each mortal with a searching eye. You can't do wrong and get by." And so you're asking yourself, if God's looking, I better not do this. But good instruction from some good Bible school teachers. But a lesson that I've learned since that time is that I needed to ask God for forgiveness, not only for the things I had done, not only for the deeds I had done, but I really needed to ask for forgiveness for what I was. That is a sinner by nature. That's what I really needed to ask for his forgiveness for. Those were good years, but Satan was always busy, as he is, and when I was about 12 years old, I started working with my father on his construction sites. It gave me a good opportunity to learn a trade, make a little bit of money, but it also exposed me to men who were not Christians, who seemed to delight in telling off-color stories, telling of their sexual exploits, and regularly using profanity. In my junior year of high school, I was able to go to Lancaster Mennonite High School. I had difficulty in fitting in. I hadn't grown up in Lancaster County. I didn't quite fit that mold. And I struggled with low self-esteem as well. But I soon discovered that one could be noticed by committing mischief, pulling pranks. And I got very good at it. Very good at committing pranks and not being caught. But eventually that does catch up with you, and it'll get you friends that you really don't need and shouldn't have. Time came and I was expelled from the dormitory there and living too far away to travel every day. I returned to Kennett High School to graduate there. Just a funny thing, at high school there, we had a number of black students, and one day a black classmate of mine said to me, he says, "I read about you people in the Bible," said, "you're the Midianites." Well, I occasionally still meet people who knew me at Lancaster Mennonite High School and are shocked or amazed or something that I'm in ministry. And I always try to tell them that it's only by the grace of God that I am what I am. So never underestimate God's grace and God's power to change us if we're willing to be changed. I did come to grips with my self-esteem issues. I came to realize that what really gave me worth was the fact that I was created in God's image and that I'm his child. Another struggle I had with at that time was I'd come to the realization that I had been conceived out of wedlock. And I struggled with feelings about that for a number of years and wondering whether I maybe had contributed in some way to problems that my parents later experienced. As I grew older, I found it increasingly easy to argue with anything my father told me. In fact, I think I loved arguing. I think I almost enjoyed that as much as eating. I would argue with him, I would argue with my siblings, but he was having some problems of his own also. His business was not doing well, and numerous times I would come home from school and see sheriff sale signs tacked up on the door. You know, on such a certain date, we're going to sell kitchen table and whatever, you know, for back taxes. So that was a fairly common thing. We also began to see less and less time of him as he spent time away from home playing in a country music band. And apparently the church leadership knew something that I didn't at that point, because one Sunday morning it was announced from the pulpit that he was being excommunicated. And no real reason given, except that he had been excommunicated. Well, in the senior year of high school then, my 9-year-old brother was killed playing softball. He was playing in a sandlot game with the neighbors, and they had a runner trapped between home and third base. And he was a catcher. They threw the ball to him. And I think like young people do sometimes, he probably threw his glove up and flinched a little bit. The ball hit him in his head, and he dropped to the ground. He got up and then dropped again and didn't move after he dropped a second time. So my mother took him to the doctor, and the doctor pronounced him dead there and said that apparently what had happened is when he had been hit, it had broken a vertebrae in the neck. And when he had got up, moved, it severed the spinal cord, which killed him. So when she returned home, she asked me to go and find my father and deliver the news to him that my brother had been killed. So I got in my car. I was driving at that time. Went to Westchester, which is 16 miles kind of northwest of where we lived. And I knew we were doing work in the area, and I knew there was a bar that they would occasionally eat lunch at. And so I found him there at the bar and told him he needed to come home because David had been killed. And I believe that that was probably the single hardest thing that I've had to do in my life. I do remember driving and praying that God would spare me from alcohol and from ungodly living. Well, sometime after this, my father lost his house. We moved a couple miles west to an old piece of property with an old fix-up house on it, and eventually built another house there. But we began to see less and less of him, and it was apparent that he was being unfaithful to my mother. He would stop in occasionally on Friday evenings and drop some money off and disappear, and we wouldn't see him again for maybe another couple weeks. And this went on for 20 years, during which time he fathered a child and raised a child with another woman. And as the oldest in the family, I felt a burden to try to step in and help my mother and my siblings where I could. I was still at home at that time, but I was out of high school and was working. And it was difficult to deal with, to try to accept what was happening. My sister, just next to me, was bitter towards my father for a good many years. And I struggled to come to peace with my father and his actions. It did have an effect on the family, and I can only wonder how it might be different today if he had been there for us. But I must say that in all the years of my father's unfaithfulness, I have never once heard my mother raise her voice to him, never argue, never say anything ill towards him to anyone else. And she would regularly take us to family functions, even though she knew she was going to have to face the questions about where my father was. The other thing she did, she worked 20 years as a nurse's aide at the county old folks' home at night, so she'd be home with the children through the day, get us off to school, get the laundry done, whatever. I don't know when she slept. But she would also get us all up on Sunday morning and get us to church on time, which is pretty amazing. I had trouble doing that sometimes with far less family, but she was committed to that. And I do credit her example of gentleness and godliness for a lot of my desire to be faithful to my God and my family. It was also during that period of time that my sister, just next to me, was diagnosed with cancer, and after treatment and a number of years of remission, had a recurrence and died at age 37. It was a difficult time for my father because of the relationship they'd had. But I do think that in the last year of her life that they had found some peace in their relationship. But at the time of her death again, my mother and father both just kind of shut down mentally and emotionally, and I was left to plan the funeral and make all the arrangements. As a teen, I was part of our district youth group, and we had a nice-sized youth group in our district at that time. There might have been 50 or 60 of us. And we would go to Philadelphia once a month to pass out the way, which was a gospel tract some of you may or may not be familiar with. We would also occasionally have the opportunity to go away for weekends to do service projects. And we had one plan for Washington, D.C., well, our supply deacon, we didn't have a deacon at Kennett at that time, and our supply deacon was Amos Yoder from Parksburg. And he would come down usually for communions and that sort of thing, whenever deacons were needed. And he had four daughters. And we boys at Kennett used to like to make fun of them, probably for no other reason than we were teenage boys. I don't know. But I remember saying the morning we were loading up to go to Washington, D.C., said, if those Yoder girls are going, I'm staying home. Well, I went, she went, and maybe you guess what happened. Dave's laughing, he knows. I even got things arranged so we could ride home in the same car together. And that's been a beginning of a 50-year journey almost, a wonderful journey with Melanie. Would have been Amos' second daughter or Dave Yoder's first cousin here. Just a side note, though, about those, the youth group. We were part of Lancaster Mennonite Conference, and Lancaster Conference at that time had rules and discipline. Had a little booklet, had everything spelled out, even what color socks we were supposed to be wearing. And in our district, it felt to a lot of us like it was administered in a very authoritarian, very heavy-handed manner. And consequently, all but one or two of the people who would have been in my age in the youth group left our district, and a number of them even left the Mennonite Church. So our district, the Millwood District, grew up, well, basically did without my generation. The people who, for the last 40 years, who should have been in leadership, who should have been in positions of responsibility, who should have been the steadying influences in the congregation, are missing. They're not there. And I believe that our district has suffered rather significantly because of that. While we were dating, I was coming home one evening, not that late either, but fell asleep and had an accident. And I started to go through the windshield of my car, and I had laying there on my back, blood running down my throat. I kept keep spitting it out so I wouldn't choke, but my windshield had gone in over top of my eyes here, and I wound up with 40 stitches to close that up. But I do remember praying that, God, if you'll save my life, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And let me just tell you, that's a dangerous prayer. But I have tried to do that since then. But Melanie had agreed to marry me. I wanted to marry her. She was right willing. And at 18, as required by the law, I had gone in to register because we were in the Vietnam War at that time, and I registered as a conscientious objector. And each registrant received a number, and we were told that if we ever had questions of how close we might be to being drafted, we were to give them a call and give them our number, and they would tell us. Melanie and I decided since we were in the middle of the Vietnam War, it might be good to check with the draft board. So I called, and they gave me my number, and they said, oh, we're past that number. And I said, thank you, and hung up and thought, maybe they'll miss me. 2 days later, I had a registered letter in the mail that said, you have 30 days to find a place to serve and to report for alternate service. So I called EMBMC, Eastern Mennonite Board of Missions and Charities, which was the mission agency associated with Lancaster Mennonite Conference, and asked for places to work, and they said, well, they really didn't have any. There would have been some close home. There was a place in Philadelphia, Byberry, where a lot of our young men went, but they could go down and work 5 days and come home on the weekends and run around and do everything else they ever did, wanted to do. And I decided I would not do that. If our military men couldn't come home, I wasn't going to do that either. So they gave me two possibilities. One was Flint, Michigan, and I read somewhere at the Sun Only shines about 3 out of 10 days in Flint, so I said, that doesn't work. And the other one was possibly, and they didn't know for sure, but Kansas City. So with a faith in my heart and a prayer on my lips, I headed for Kansas City, and had only the phone number of the pastor in my pocket when I got there, but called him and got a cab out, and was the pastor of the Argentine Mennonite Church, who was John Paul Wenger, son of J.C. Wenger, which is a familiar name to some of you. So had opportunity over the years to meet J.C. on a number of occasions there in their home and in the congregation. But the pastor called a young 1W man from Ohio who came, picked me up, took me up to the hospital, helped me get a job there, helped me find a room to live in. And it was the beginning of a very good experience, a 2-year experience. I lived, there was no 1W unit there as such, So I was able to spend a lot of spare time at the Kansas City Mennonite Children's Home doing repairs, fixing bikes, unstopping toilets, whatever maintenance work needed to be done. And living in a room by myself on the second floor gave me a lot of time to read and to sort out what I really believed, to strengthen my convictions, and to try to determine what direction I was going to take in life. I was able to get home twice in 2 years, and Melanie came out once to visit me. I flew in the first time. She was in an automobile accident that almost killed her, and she spent 6 weeks in the hospital. I just wanted to get home to see her. So I got home, and I got home once for Christmas. And I debated whether I should bring her to Kansas or not. But I got word a month before my service was over that I'd been elected to serve as superintendent back in my home congregation. So I thought, well, maybe that's the Lord telling me I better go back home again. So I returned home, and 6 months later we were married. And Lord willing, this coming April we'll celebrate our 45th wedding anniversary. We started our married life in Kennett Square, right in town itself, in a small apartment. And I worked in the masonry industry for 45 years. And a number of those years, I was a foreman for masonry crew. And it was quite an experience. I don't recall ever having a man in all those years that I worked with that I would have considered a Christian man. And one of the problems as a foreman was that I didn't use profanity. Now, that doesn't sound like a problem, does it? But these men were accustomed to profanity. And the only way they really thought you were serious is if you use profanity, and the more profanity you use, the more serious you were. So the challenge for me was, how do I get a crew to function under my directions without using profanity? Well, that was a journey in and of itself. But it was good to be, I'm not sure how to say this. There were some blessings, I think, that came to me through working in that environment and knowing that I'm different. And I need to live differently, and I need to live in a way that is consistent with the faith that I proclaim. So I worked there. While I was doing that, also served with a local fire company and ran ambulance for about 15 years until I was called to ministry. Then it's just too much stuff. I need to give something up. Melanie, at the same time, was at home taking care of our two children. We had a son and a daughter. But both of us had experienced some things in our home growing up that we determined we were not going to have be part of our home. And that, of course, led to some bumps along the way, I think. Maybe we weren't always in agreement, but we've had a good relationship. It's been a wonderful relationship. But in 1979, our pastor of over 25 years suddenly resigned, leaving our congregation in need of a pastor. Mine was the only name that received the required nominations, and I was licensed for 2 years and then ordained. To say the least, this brought a lot of change to my life as well. I served in every capacity before, like I'd said, but this was still something new. I had never served as pastor. And I was the only pastor for quite a few years and carried full responsibility for leadership. In later years, then, we were able to install two elders, which helped make up a leadership team that would help me give some direction to the life of the congregation. Working full-time and pastoring, I realize, I've readily acknowledged there were things that could have been done and should have been done that didn't get done. That was just the reality of it. I very quickly realized my need for God's help to accomplish the responsibilities of my calling. Our district ministry would meet once a month, and that was a good learning time for me. In those early years, we needed to approve, as a district ministry, we needed to approve every slate for every election that the congregations held. We needed to approve every outside speaker that came into any of those churches. We needed to deal with the rules and disciplines issue, and we needed to approve any ordination requests, and then subsequently the candidates. So it was kind of quite a learning experience for me. Church authority and governance was very centralized. And then around 1981, I believe, I may not be quite correct on that date, but proposal was brought to conference ministry to vote on doing away with conference rules and regulations, and that vote did pass. So at that point, congregations were free to function more autonomously as long as they operated within the guidelines of the 63 Confession of Faith. Well, what that did, it led to the beginning of what today I would call a very wide diversity that leads to a lot of problems of its own. In the last years on Bishop Board, we struggled with how to get this thing back together. You know, it had gone so far. It just seemed to be no way to pull all of that back together. Also, in the early years of ministry, then I was asked by our district ministry to serve on a small committee of the bishop, myself, and one other brother to work with a brother minister who had become involved sexually with two married women. And it was a difficult process at times, and eventually we determined, or felt at least we determined, that we needed to rescind his credentials, need to terminate his credentials, much to his displeasure and protest. But I share that to say that I've learned several things through that process. And this is before email, texting, and any of that. But let me just say that face-to-face conversation is better than over the telephone. Anytime. Sit down with the brother across the table and share openly. You need to do that. You need to talk. Secondly, excuse me, where my notes are here now. Yeah, the office doesn't belong to the pastor. The office belongs to the church. We serve in that capacity because God has called us and the church has affirmed us. But the office belongs to the church, not us. And so we can't demand to hang on to it if we're not going to conduct ourselves in the way that we ought to conduct ourselves. And the third thing, and I think this is extremely important, if we lose the congregation's trust, we have lost almost any possibility of serving them in any meaningful ways. Now, I just think that's so crucial. If we lose the congregation's trust, we have lost our platform, so to speak. We've lost any way to function effectively and meaningfully within the congregation. On another occasion, I was asked by our district ministry to attend a meeting in one of our congregations as a listener and report back to the district ministry. A outside person had been called in to deal with a problem in that congregation, and as I listened, I discovered that what had been named as the problem really wasn't the problem. It was much deeper. And as the discussion went on, people were dragging up hurts and things they were dissatisfied with from years ago that had never been resolved and kept throwing them on that wagon. And so I think through that process I learned that whether it's church or interpersonal problems, there's usually more involved than meets the eye. And that until we have the whole story, it's hard for us to make informed decisions and come to any helpful conclusions. Serving by myself and for many years, I learned that there were times that I would need to make personal sacrifice to serve those in my congregation and sometimes in the community. My time and energy wasn't just mine. It meant being away from home evenings. It meant evenings and pastoral training events, sometimes even missing family functions for those events. It wasn't always easy. You don't get to sleep when you get a call in the middle of the night that someone's son's been killed and they're at the hospital. You don't get to sleep when a fellow pastor calls you and says, would you go with me to meet with a family whose child is just drowned in the bathtub? You don't get to turn your back on friends when they call in the middle of the night and are on a difficult journey and need you to help them walk through it. But it also has its rewards. My father, who had been out of fellowship for 20 years, called me one evening and said, you know, I'm tired of this. I don't want to make things right. I want to get back in a right relationship with the Lord, with the church. And so we worked through that process, and he was taken into, made his confession, was taken into membership the same day my son was baptized. Had a lady in the congregation Her mother had been a member at our church. She had never been a member. Married, moved to Boston, became involved in drugs and alcohol and infidelity. Came back into our area, accepted the Lord, and became a member in our congregation. And I remember saying to her one Sunday morning, I said, "You look a bit discouraged." And she said, "I am." But the blessing was, she said, "I'm not going back. There's nothing worth going back to." Also, we had a young man who went to Brazil working for MCC, and they were having severe drought. And he felt the Lord leading him to dig a dam. He got local help. They created the dam to trap water once it rained so they could take water out of there for irrigation. And they finished it. He called his parents, who were members of Kennet also, and asked us to pray for rain. So we called a meeting on a Wednesday evening to pray just for rain. We got a call the following morning telling us that at just the time we prayed, what do you think happened? It rained. So there are blessings. There are struggles. It was during that time also in my life then that I was asked to serve on an advisory committee for a Spanish health ministry in our community, a ministry that was attempting to meet prenatal needs of Hispanic women in our community, and I served on that in that capacity for 27 years and saw that grow from just meeting prenatal health care needs to meeting high-risk postnatal needs as well in these families. It was also during that time I had privilege then to work with other local Christians in starting a community ministry to do home repairs in our home community. But one of my regrets as a pastor was that I was never quite able to get the people in my congregation involved in either of those two ministries. For one thing, they weren't Mennonite ministries. But I experienced tremendous blessing in working with other believers, although we didn't always agree, but working to meet the common needs in the community. Well, in 2000, I was ordained to serve as bishop, overseer of the Millwood District of Lancaster Conference, and that seemed like a really daunting task. To sit down with men of the caliber of many of those bishops to help make decisions and set directions for 21,000 people seemed like more than I felt qualified for. And to add to matters, we were right at the place where we needed to make a decision about joining or not joining MCUSA as a conference. And I happened to be in the minority of the bishops who was opposed to joining MCUSA. But eventually, the decision was made, and conference did become a part of MCUSA. And as difficult as that decision was, we were faced almost immediately with a women in leadership issue. Was brought to the table again. And again, I was in a minority. But there was a strong appeal from the leadership of conference to remain, for those of us who disapproved or weren't in favor of, to at least remain at the table, to remain engaged in the conversation to help shape the discussion and the final vote. I committed myself to do that, although at times it was a difficult position to be in. At one time, I had 80 pages, and not just 80 pages with one email. I cut and pasted emails till a page was full. I had 80 pages of emails from persons urging bishops to support women in leadership, and some of them didn't have a very soft tone to them either. But eventually, the majority of bishops approved a recommendation to conference asking them to approve allowing congregations who felt called to do so to ordain women while at the same time honoring those who refused to do so. That recommendation failed by the narrowest of margins, and that created another uproar. And so some of the bishops and bishop board began to look for ways around the decision, and unfortunately have been able to find a way around that and currently do ordain women when it's called for. Those were trying times for me because I did love my brothers on the board. I enjoyed and benefited from the many discussions and the issues we tackled. There were good men on the board and good minds, a lot of good discussion, because not all the issues we tackled were women in leadership or homosexuality issues. And so it was really good to learn from them, to be blessed by my relationship with them. At the same time, I realized that my convictions were going to require that I disassociate myself with the board, but I wanted to be able to leave in such a way that I could look each of my brothers in the eye and shake their hand. After my ordination again in 2000, we installed a lay pastor at Kennett so I could give more attention to my new responsibilities, and congregation there never was large, but we were in a period of decline. It seemed that we were having difficulty in making change that was acceptable to some of our older people. Now I'm in that group, but we tried small groups. We tried a very mild form of a worship team. We tried some new things that the young people wanted to try, and the older folks just left us know in no uncertain terms that they weren't happy with things. And what happened is eventually all of our young people left. And so we continued to further decline. We had talked a number of times about closing the congregation, and there was always that hesitation. And then in 2005, I knew the end had to be near, and I talked to Spanish Mennonite Council about whether they would have any interest in starting a Hispanic work in Kennett Square, which is a heavily populated area with Hispanics. They said there was. They had actually been praying about that possibility. And I'd asked them about whether they had a time frame in mind, and they said they were thinking maybe fall of that year. So I had that information, and then in the summer of that year, our lay pastor died, and one other member in the congregation that we were concerned about from the community where they would plug in also died. And suddenly it seemed like the time had come to make that decision. So I shared with the congregation about my conversation with Spanish Mennonite Council, and we decided that we were going to give them the building, invite them down, just give them the building. Here it is, keys, everything. Everything in there is yours. You walk in, take over. And there were some stipulations about the sale of the building in the future and so on, but I'm not going to get into that. But we had a service of blessing then for them and one of closure for us, which really felt right. And I checked the directory just before I came up this weekend. There are now 24 baptized Hispanic members in that congregation there. So we needed to keep the membership, even though we closed the church in 2005, we needed to keep the membership roll open until all the legal matters were solved. Because we were giving the building to Spanish Mennonite Council without any money changing hands, we had to go through the courts of Pennsylvania, which took a period of time. And we had to keep several members on the roster at Kennett so that we could make legal decisions. When that took place in 2007, then we took our membership to Millwood. Millwood graciously accepted us, and I made that known to conference leadership, and I told them I understood that would mean the termination of my credentials. And Keith Weaver, moderator, said no. He said, "We don't want to do that." He said, "We don't want to terminate you." He said, "You're old enough to apply for retirement. Why don't you do that?" So I did, and that was approved, so I was retired as bishop there. But came to Millwood then, and Millwood asked me to continue to serve as overseer there until we became part of BMA, at which time Jay Lockman has become our overseer. It's not an easy thing to leave a conference that you've been involved with for so many years, and some of you know that. There are still fine Christian brothers as well as congregations who are still seeking to be faithful. But in the setting in which I found myself, I just felt disenfranchised. And I recall feeling after returning from convention in Plain City that I had found a place to call home, a place to belong. But in the end, it's not about conferences, it's not about associations, but it's about Him. It's about being faithful to the call that He's placed on our lives. It's about walking in the light and ministering in integrity and transparency. So I share my story this morning, not for any recognition or merit. I readily acknowledge my many failures and shortcomings. I share this today to hopefully encourage each of us to allow the circumstances and the difficulties of life shape us into what God would have us to be, to bless others and to be blessed in our calling. And I want to encourage each of you, my brothers here this morning, to hang in there, to be faithful, to make full proof of your ministry. And encourage each of you wives to stand with your husbands in prayer, support, and encouragement so that all of us can come to the end of our journey, be able to say with the Apostle Paul, "I have fought the good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith."
God bless you.